This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
I want to break with that idea that people have of sustainability, which is like granola eating, tree hugging, and Birkenstock wearing, you know? Sustainability is luxury. It shouldn't be two competing concepts.
Hello and welcome to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I'm talking to people at the top of the creative arts and industries. Today, my guest is the designer Gabriella Hurst. She comes from a pretty unusual background for a designer, a 17,000-acre ranch in Uruguay. And her women's wear combines luxurious materials with pragmatic utilitarianism. Issues around sustainability are increasingly important in the fashion world, but they've always been at the forefront of Gabriella's mind. Her work reflects her passion for producing luxury while minimizing the impact she has on the environment. Gabriella, I thought we could start off by talking about your childhood. Let's start at the beginning, because you have got quite an unusual background for a designer, quite an unusual background for anyone, really, having grown up on this vast ranch in Uruguay. Tell me a bit about that childhood.
I can say now with time, it's quite a romantic way to grow up. When I was there, I wanted to leave, because that's what everyone in my family has done, been ranchers. In my mom's ranch, they've been there for 170 years next year. I'm the seventh generation, but...
170 years.
Yeah, and that's...
This is like totally Gabriel Garcia Marquez, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very much like that. My dad also is a rancher, and my stepdad. So that was the life that we all had. And I grew up in a ranch till I was 5 years old, where I was sent to study to a British schools in the city.
So who were your companions when, you know, between sort of zero and five?
Pretty much myself and you know, my mind, till my brother was born, and I wasn't really delighted about him. So, because he was a boy, and I had thinking like boys will get more attention or something. But till age five, it was pretty much in nature. And one of the things that I think really for me was to ride horses, since I don't remember when I was taught how to ride horses. And I think that that gives a little kid a certain confidence, subconsciously speaking, right?
That's interesting. Yeah, it probably does.
Because this is a big animal and you're a small person, and that gives that confidence to it.
It must have been quite a shock as a five-year-old to go from the freedom of the ranch and riding every day and to find yourself in Montevideo at a English boarding school.
I was lucky because I didn't have to board, but because I was living with my grandmother in the city, and she like spoiled me rotten. So it was very, still is a very quiet city, still 2 million people in Montevideo.
Still, but a lot more than on the 17,000 acre ranch.
I know. But I spent every summer of my life in the ranch and every vacation. So it was holiday, it was like herding cattle, you know.
But what must have seemed to you really alluring was the idea of the metropolis, of a kind of urban life.
Yes. It's really funny that you point that out, because that's exactly it. When you're surrounded by so much space and nature and animals, you're very curious about people. So since a very young age, I wanted to travel, and I was always putting myself in trips, you know, in school trips. And so at 17, I left to live in Australia for a year. And since then, I was back in Uruguay, but always wanting to travel.
When did you realize that you had an interest in clothes? I think I read somewhere about you rifling through your grandmother's wardrobe rather than your mother's.
My mother didn't have a lot of clothes, but they had really beautiful clothes, because it was made, like, the nicest thing you could do was make them with seamstresses, with European fabrics, and everything was made to measure. And they're basically couture. But the story that you're talking about is when I watched Cinderella, you know, when the mice start to do the dress, I thought to myself, oh, I can do that. And so I went to my grandmother's handmade lace silk sleeping gown and started cutting them to make a dress. And I remember my grandmother's reaction was laughing instead of killing me, which I thought it was actually quite, you know, nice. But recently, going through my journals. I've always had journals. I had designed a whole shoe collection at 16.
No way.
And then some of them, I'm like, I should redo this. So it was always kind of in me, but there wasn't like a design school or wasn't even a possibility that that would be a job for me. So I never really had that as that's the place where I'm going to end up. But somewhere in the subconscious, I guess I was going towards it.
And what was it about clothes, accessories that inspired you? Because I would have thought that, you know, having grown up a bit of a tomboy, mm-hmm. maybe on the ranch in Uruguay, that those would have been things that actually weren't of particular interest to you.
Well, my mother was the queen of the tomboys. She used to compete in rodeo, and then she became a taekwondo black belt and a Zen Buddhist that shaved her head. And so I guess that was a bit maybe more reactionary to that. And my dad, believe it or not, had a very specific aesthetic eye. The way he dressed, the way he decorated the houses. It was his taste always. And so I inherited that from him. I was always drawn to certain elements of what I consider beauty and harmony and what makes me feel at peace. And I always loved clothes, you know, how that makes you feel and change and what makes you comfortable.
So what for you are those elements of beauty and harmony that constitute luxurious item?
First is the materials where they're made, and then the way it's constructed for durability. The things that I'm always attracted to are things that are made to pass the test of time, like a Greek earring from the 3rd century. You know, it's so modern, or anything that's made with time and process. Usually there's a lot of passion behind that when somebody wants to create a product of a high caliber. So that's what I'm drawn to. And I always try to replicate that on the products that we make.
And you started, though, making T-shirts, yeah. I think, making T-shirts of a winged woman
on a horse. Which is my mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's the same image that I'm using for the campaign that we're going to do in September. It's this image of my mom on a horse, and the horse is lifting its legs up. And it's quite a strong image.
And why? I mean, most girls in their 20s are trying to get away from their mothers, not iconify them on a T-shirt or anything else. What was it, do you think, that made you want to use that particular image? And why did you set out making T-shirts? How did it happen?
Because I had $700 to do it. So it wasn't a lot of things that I could do with it.
It wasn't going to be couture gowns.
It wasn't, but they were cool. And we launched a business with that. And then it actually started to take off. And because it was my last chance in New York, or I had to make it, or I had to go back to sell cows with my dad. I had a contemporary line, which I wasn't happy because we had to like lower the quality and the standards all the time to meet the demands of the department stores. And I was just like losing the identity I wanted it to have because I started it from scratch in 2003.
Where was that pressure coming from, and why did you react so much against it, do you think?
I think instinctively I reacted because I was, you know, getting older, and I thought, because it's not only that you're making a product cheaper, right? Because the department store is asking you to make it cheaper to have this competitive price point. But it's also, what is the price of the world that the world is paying for that cheap product? It felt intrinsically wrong. It started to feel, and I couldn't elevate the brand. You cannot take a brand that's from here up and never works. So I had to start from scratch, which was, you know, a process. I thought about it for 2 years because I, you know, it's hard to start from scratch.
Yeah, when you've managed to establish something over 10 years.
And at 38 years old. So I wasn't getting any younger. So I thought, if I do it, you know, I'm going to do it now. So we launched when I was 39, pregnant of my 3rd son, 8 months pregnant. And
clearly all those hormones were charging around your brain, making you reckless.
I actually get very excited when 1 year we had 5 team members pregnant, and there's an efficiency that happens when women are pregnant. It's actually like, yeah, more pregnant women, because they become so productive. And so there's something that happens, I think, in endocrinology. And it's been a very, very interesting 5 years, because I felt that my vision had finally crystallized.
So did you set out, I think it was 2015 when you launched, did you set out with the idea of creating a sustainable fashion brand that was for an upmarket clientele, mm-hmm. that would be unique and original? Or did all the elements sort of slowly weaved themselves together because you wanted to take it upmarket. You didn't want to be mass producing.
No, I set up with understanding about it. You know, it was always, that was one of the values, long-term view and sustainability. But the process really accelerated to more than just the garment after I saw the drought in Africa in 2017, which was the year that there were more humanitarian crises, and a lot of them were based in climate change. And when I went to the Horn of Africa and saw that drought, because it was affecting 20 million people in the risk of famine, and I saw mass screening of children with malnutrition, I saw women digging holes of dead riverbeds for hours and hours to get water at about 8 hours a day. And I got enraged, I guess, that the people that did the least in this mess that we're in are paying the higher price first, because we're all going to pay the price. And so I had to like put the pedal to the metal, as they say. First, we did an initiative for them and help them through the drought. And then I wanted to get rid of everything that was plastic in our company. So starting in April of 2000 and this year, all our packaging is biodegradable. Everything that we're shipping, they are actually biodegradable cardboard hangers. And then I developed with Tipa, which is this Israeli company, which is a flexible packaging. I developed the garment bags, the transparent garment bags that biodegrade in 24 weeks versus regular plastic that's 500 years. So that was a big effort. And then we're trying to move out of virgin materials.
I mean, you know, one of the easy things for people to say if they want to kind of go, you know, it's all very well talking about, you know, global warming and climate change and everything, but, you know, is that the change can happen at the top end of the scale, you know, where people are paying thousands of pounds for a dress or, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds for a jumper and so on, but that it that doesn't translate to the people at the other end. And I wonder how you balance those things, because you're clearly very animated about you know, playing your part in combating climate change. But at the same time, I guess you're making things that, you know, only people who fly around the world and use the resources in other ways can buy.
Well, I think that if you're, for example, a mother, a single mother of two kids, and you're trying to meet ends means, you're not going to be worrying about climate change. But I think that anyone that has the privilege of not having to worry about that should take the responsibility. So with privilege comes responsibility. I really can't justify the love that I have for what I do if I know I'm damaging, taking more from the planet that's already given so much and cannot give more. So I am really trying to find a way on this very complicated subject, which is not as complicated as people think. It's just using a lot of common sense and checking with scientists, by the way. I have a saying now that it's like scientists and artists are going to take us out from this mess, because you need both.
Do you feel also a sort of responsibility to educate your clients on why the things that they're buying are, why they're making a positive choice, for example, by choosing your things?
Yes, I try to do that. I'm very clear that our client is choosing our product because they desire, because it's beautiful, and that's really important, because beauty is important. Beauty can transform and inspire people. You know, it works for churches. You know, they didn't make them ugly.
Always work for religion, yeah.
And in a way, it's kind of, I want to break with that idea that people have of sustainability, which is like granola eating, tree hugging, and Birkenstock wearing, you know?
There's only so many beans each of us can eat in
exactly,
a lifetime.
Exactly. So it's luxury. Sustainability is luxury. It shouldn't be two competing concepts.
How do you define what a Gabriella Hearst concept is? I mean, today you're wearing the most deliciously gorgeous sort of crushed raspberry coloured linen suit, I think, trouser suit.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm a huge fan because I already love a trouser suit, but that's a very feminine trouser suit.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful fabric too. It's a wool linen. And another thing that people may not know about all our jackets and coats, they are lined, they have a third lining pocket that you don't see it is actually silver, which you can put your cell phone and it protects you from anti-radiation. So you could put your cell phones next to your pocket. So that defines like a really Hearst.
But everything you make has that lining.
Yeah, everything that has pockets that you're going to put here.
Yeah.
Just on the pocket side. And then you have the hardware. So it's that's the Gavrila Hearst.
Hardware, she means buckles at the moment, here. I think. Very, very dainty, beautiful buckles.
They're stirrups for the riding nod. So that's...
So we're going back to your early riding with this.
So it's all about these little details and the utilitarian aspect. The process starts two ways for me. Sometimes I sketch. And then sometimes I just have these clear visions of like... a look, a boot, an object. It's just very, very clear. And when it becomes very clear, it's like full on to make it realization from mind to reality. And other times it's really the material that speaks to me. And so the Gavrila Hearst product is a product that definitely has beauty and durability and quality, and it makes you feel good. It has a good hand.
Tell me about the aloe linen, for example.
Yes, I love the aloe linen because it's in Europe, people have no problem wearing linen. But in America, they find it scratchy. And
that's so funny. My daughter finds it scratchy. I've got linen sheets on my bed that love, I
love linen sheets.
Yeah, and she says, oh, they're so scratchy. So they feel soapy and scratchy. I don't get it.
No, I don't know. I don't know what's with the kids and everything soft.
Too spoiled.
I know, probably, right?
Put them on a farm.
That works. And when I saw this linen that was treated with aloe and the hand was so much softer, I'm like, that's perfect. That's what we need for the American market. And the reason why I love linen so much, because it's a much more complete fiber than cotton, because it absorb less water than cotton, and at the same time you can eat the flax seed, so it has additional values and nutritional values. So, you know, I'll have dresses in our collection. Even a client recently thought, oh, I bought this beautiful denim dress from you, and I'm like, yeah, it's not denim, it's actually wool and linen. So I have this thing that I like to make things looking one way and they're actually other. There's these rustic hand-knit sweaters that you look at them and they look like these rustic sweaters and they come in all these colors, but you touch it and it's the most soft cashmere you've ever seen. And so if you see it in a photograph, you don't really appreciate it. And that's the thing about us. We're really clothed for the physical world. It's about the touch. It's about how things look in person.
There also seems to be a sort of, not a conflict, but an engagement between what might be seen as sort of functional and even vaguely what would have been seen as masculine, perhaps, you know, 20 years ago, and yet with a sort of female influence that gives it a much more flowing, softer form.
Yeah, I obviously have a very masculine side because I design with a certain edge, and I kind of tend away when things feel a bit too feminine. I try to put a raw edge or make it a little bit unperfect, let's say.
And tell me about the, because I think you use a women's cooperative in Uruguay.
Manos. Yeah.
Yeah.
Manos del Uruguay is an incredible...
Manos de Uruguay, hands of Uruguay. Uruguay.
Yeah, exactly. And it was founded 50 years ago with these two visionaries that they saw a problem, which is now a current problem worldwide, where they saw the rural woman migrating to the urban city. And what happens in developing countries, they have those circles of poverty that start becoming. So but when they think that they were going to go and get a better life, actually, it's a worse standard of living. So Olga Pardo Santayana, which was one of the founders, they decided to employ women, give women the jobs in the local community. And, you know, these are data from Save the Children, where you empower women, you empower a family, you empower a community. If you give the women power of the women in the family, everyone benefits. They've been around for 50 years and they employed around 600 women in the country. And they all make the product by hand. But again, the reason why I work with them is because they make a great product. Because if they had all these good intentions, but they couldn't make the product the right way, I couldn't work with them. So they do all our hand knit.
You've said that that your idea of luxury was born out of your experiences living on the ranch.
Yeah.
And I wondered how that was, because I sort of imagine hard wooden furniture and sparse rooms and white walls, and that's just my idea. but
it's not far. But it's not far. But it comes from things being well made because they have to last. So when you're 2 hours and a half away from the closest city, and it's not like you're going buying, you know, every generation goes by furniture or something. No, you kind of tend to inherit the furniture from generation to generation. And so things are made to last. So my sense of luxury, my point of view of luxury, is this well-crafted, beautiful product that can last. It's well with, made with integrity and noble materials, but not necessarily ostentatious. It has a simplicity to it.
But it's not what our sort of business model in the capitalist world is based on. That's based on me buying a sweater from you and a year later when it's got a hole in it, or, you know, when it's falling apart, buying another one and another one.
My goal is that you don't have to buy another one. My goal is that that one lasts.
But then surely you're going to have shareholders going,
well, there are problems. I believe that you have to buy a few, but good.
I wondered if there was a particular, you know, we talked about the ethos of your design, mm-hmm. but if there's a particular kind of woman that you're designing for, and about the sort of women that you have cited as being your role models in the past.
This is the most fantastic thing, because I've had this vision of who this woman is, and she's this dynamic woman doing things in the world. And
with wings on a horse.
not physical wings, but wings in their brains for sure, and driven. And when I started to meet my clients, and there are these women, you know, they're like bioengineers, and a client that actually became a friend is one of the experts in healthcare in the US. That it's just these really brilliant, intelligent women that are super dynamic in the world, and they love what we do, because first they feel very beautiful. Like one of our clients was speaking in a Fortune 500 conference, and it was a very important subject. And then everybody was texting her, "What's the suit you're wearing?" Because as you said before, they want to look good. They want to look professional, but they don't want to look like boring either.
Is there somebody, I mean, this is always really quite difficult, but is there somebody that you would love to dress that kind of epitomizes the sort of woman that your clothes are for? Hmm. Or maybe you've dressed them already.
I've been very lucky of dressing. I have one standard for dressing women and men. Anyone that has a spotlight, if they share it with other people. So if they use their voice and their spotlight to help others that need it, that's the people I want to dress. So I get lucky that I get to, you know, I dress Jill Biden. I mean, Oprah has wore her stuff. I mean, a lot of...
Angela Davis.
Yeah. No, Angela Davis, I was my muse. I haven't dressed her, but I would like to dress her. I mean, there's so many women that I admire. So, but yeah, in that common denominator of women that use their power for service is really... the role models.
How much are you interested in the science of it? I mean, I know you've won like the Woolmark award and so on, and you're quite committed to developing new ways of working with wool and so on. So is that a sort of part of your brain that you've recently engaged, or is there a bit of you that quite likes the science of things?
I think you cannot call yourself, in my book, right? You cannot call yourself a luxury designer if you do not understand the whole process, where things come from. Because that's the key thing about luxury. Where things come from and what is the quality of each of your ingredients that you're putting into this garment. So if you're a luxury designer, you need to understand the process. My brain is always educating itself and trying to learn more and more of each. I know each component of each of my products, and it should be like that in my book.
What do you think are the most luxurious elements that you work with? We've talked about the aloe linen, but for you, what are they?
The cashmeres are always beautiful. The one I just told you about, the double face cashmere. And then we've used this wool for resort, which is a double face wool that no one uses for a suit. And then we have a cashmere gauze. I mean, I can go on and on. You have to stop me. A cashmere gauze, which is a mix. It's, you look at it and you think it's a cotton gauze or a cotton voile, and it's actually cashmere and wool, and it's super thin. It was in our spring collection. So then I actually have to train my team, because everybody's trained to like find like the cheaper thing for the better margin, where I explain to them all the time that if we need to continue the path of quality, because society-wise, we're all going lower and lower in certain aspects where people are cutting corners, and it shows.
Do you consider the price tag at all when you're looking at the components for your clothes?
My decision-making process in that, if it needs to be for the endurance of the garment, we do it. But if it's like something that is decadent, if it doesn't have a real functionality, I won't do it. But I want the construction on the inside and the outside to be, yeah, pretty well done.
And you sound like you're incredibly committed to women and the concept of dressing them, and quite political about, you know, supporting them. But you're about to make menswear.
Yes.
Why?
Because of that masculine thing that you talked about. For my advantage as a designer is that I'm a woman, so I can understand our psychology. I understand water retention. To be doing men, I had to do a collaboration with a man because it's, you know, it's a species that I'm still trying to understand. So working with Peter Miles, which is our art director, and he's British, and he's one of these guys that I've always liked his style, really well put together, but not fussy and natural. And the interesting thing that we're going to do is we're going to put the men's in the same women's rack, because there's a lot of the men's pieces that I would like, and I know that a lot of our clients would like them too. So they're not going to be in separate racks.
Oh, interesting.
So they're not going to be, oh, here's the men's rack. It's going to be one rack.
One of the sort of iconic things you've already managed to create in a very, very short period of time, I have to say, is the Nina bag, which I believe was named after Nina Simone. Why did she inspire you to make a round handbag?
It wasn't that she inspired me to do the round handbag. Is I named them after singers, and the first one was Nina because, you know, I don't really believe in religion, but I believe in Nina Simone. The first bag had to be Nina. And the second one is called Demi because Demi Moore wanted a Nina but wanted it smaller. So it's called Demi. And then we have Diana and Ross. This is Diana.
I love Diana. Diana folds out like an accordion.
Yeah, and this is a prototype that I've been carrying around for a long time, 2 years already, and it's in one. Perfect.
You have a habit of carrying your prototype bags around, don't you?
I'm
getting noticed by people.
Yeah, because I'm not wasteful.
Should we bring up Claridge's and the lift?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that was kind of the sign. The whole handbag thing happened because I launched with shoes and ready to wear. No handbags. So I had a British friend of mine, Ben, that called me and said, you know, you can't be walking around with your shoes and you're ready to wear somebody else's handbag. And I'm like, you know what? You have a point. So I made the first handbag, the Nina, for me, but it was with no deadline or anything. So we launched in February, and by October I had a prototype of the Nina, which I was carrying around. And I was thinking I'm going to do 25 and I'm going to give them to women I admire. I came to London. I was with a handbag in the elevator, and the handbag opens in a special way. And this gentleman says, "Oh, that's an interesting bag. Who makes it?" And I said, "Myself. This is my prototype. I may do 25 of these." And he says, "Oh, if you do one, I would like one for my wife." And he gives me his card. And it's Johnny Ive from Apple.
So that's the sort of person you want admiring your prototype,
exactly.
Isn't it? Did you know in that moment it was a good design?
I was like, I took it as a sign. So I made the 25 and I sent one to him. He sent me an iPad Pro. And then this 25 then became a wait list of 100 because Brie Larson wore it before the Oscars. And then it just kind of grew and grew. And I never wholesale the bags. I've never sold it to stores. So I don't launch handbag collection. I work in individual handbags till they're ready. So they are the most creative part of our business, and it represents 50% of our business.
And have you experienced the Megan effect on the Nina handbag?
Yes, I experienced the Megan, the Oprah, the Demi. Yes, of course.
Celebrity sells. And I think you've brought me along a luxury item today that reflects, you know, for you what luxury is. And I'm surprised that there isn't a giant box somewhere with a pair of riding boots in
No. So I brought a book, actually, because for me, the ultimate luxury is time. And I didn't know how to symbolize time. So I said, "With what is the thing that if I had more time, I would like to do more, which is I read, but I would like to read more." So I bought you the next book that I'm going to start reading now in London, which is The Uninhabitable Earth, The Life After Warning.
That sounds like quite a depressing title.
Well, but we got to come to the realization.
So David Wallace Wells has produced a willfully terrifying polemic that reads like a cross between Stephen King and Stephen Hawking. The Uninhabitable Earth hits you like a comet. So you really are very serious about the planet.
We should all be very serious about the planet.
Do you ever stop doing things for good and do things just to relax and get some time?
Yeah, I dance. I'm a really good dancer.
Are you?
Yeah, and I'm extremely funny. You have to have a sense of humor to deal with this, all these things. I want my children to know that I did not stand on the side and didn't do or participate. It's important because it's going to happen. It's happening. And so for me, it's important that they know that I tried to do something. And I also think it's my survival instinct in me where, you know, some people freeze in certain situations
in
of fear.
Yeah.
And so I don't freeze in fear. I just need to march forward. It's so daunting. Our brain does not want to even deal with it, you know, because it's just so daunting. A million species point of extinction. You know, it's just a lot of this data that you're like, how the hell did we get here? But also I support the lawsuit in the United States. That's Juliana versus the United States, with his 21 children suing the United States government. Because they basically have proved them for past 50 years, Democrats and Republican presidents knew that burning fossil fuels will create, the carbon dioxide will destabilize the atmosphere and the acidity of the ocean. These facts were known and they continue doing it. So, and as I said before, if you're in a position of privilege, you have to do something.
And if you're in the position of privilege that you could go to any department in Harrods you wanted to today and pick up some little something that you really wanted, where would you go and spend some time?
The food court is amazing. You want to eat everything there.
What's your most tempting food? Because you look very healthy.
Yeah. Well, a chocolate, I'm always like, anything chocolate, I'm like in.
Yeah, and what about that grilled cheese that you get a lot of in South America?
You mean, oh, the provolone?
Yeah.
Oh, the provolone is amazing. Anything barbecue too. And
pretty fattening.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty good. I'm not scared of fat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gabriella Hirst.
Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Gabriella Hirst. Next week, I meet the designer Olivia von Halle, who tells me how late nights in Singapore inspired her luxury brand of pajamas. This series is recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.